He reassured him they would soon be rescued. Max said nothing. The night chill gave way to a sweltering day. The men were hungry, but they could do nothing about it. The fishing gear was useless. There was no bait. As they lay in silence, a purring sound drifted between their thoughts. Searching the sky, they saw a bomber well to the east. Flying much too high to be a search plane, it was probably headed to Palmyra. Louis lunged for the flare gun, loaded it, aimed high, and squeezed the trigger. The gun bucked in his hand, and the flare streaked up. As it shot overhead, Louis shook a sea dye pack into the water. A pool of vivid yellow bloomed over the ocean. Louis, Phil, and Mac watched the bomber, hoping, hoping. Slowly the flare sputtered out. The bomber kept going, then was gone. The sighting gave the castaways a distressing piece of information. They hadn't known in which direction they were drifting. Since the Hawaii-Palmyra flight lane ran near Green Hornet's crash site, the appearance of a bomber far to the east meant the rafts were drifting west, away from the view of friendly planes. Their chances of rescue were already dimming. That evening, the search planes returned to their bases. No one had seen anything. They'd be back up at first light. Phil slept for most of the following day. Louis thought about food. Mac hunkered down. For another day, rescue didn't come. On the third morning, they again heard engines. Then, there it was, a B-24, low and right overhead, plowing through the clouds, a search plane. Louis fired the flare gun. The flare shot at the bomber, and for a moment, the men thought it would hit the plane. It missed, passing alongside and making a fountain of red. Louis reloaded and fired three more flares. The plane was Daisy May. Its crewmen were straining their eyes at the ocean, passing binoculars between them. But with clouds closing and parting, searching was extremely difficult. The flares died, and Daisy May flew on. No one aboard saw anything. The castaway's best chance of rescue was lost. Every hour, they were farther west. If they weren't found, their only hope would be to find land. Ahead, there wasn't a single island for some 2,000 miles. If by some miracle they made it that far alive, they might reach the Marshall or Gilbert Islands. Then, they'd have another problem. Both sets of islands belonged to the Japanese. Watching Daisy May fly away, Louis had a dark feeling. The castaways' bodies were declining. They drank the last of their water and were intensely thirsty and hungry. They spent another frigid night, then a long fourth day. They knew if the search hadn't been called off, it soon would be. On the fifth day, Mac snapped. After having said almost nothing for days, he suddenly began screaming that they were doomed. Wild-eyed and raving, he couldn't stop shouting. Louis slapped him. Mac went silent. As the lost men drifted into oblivion, their last letters reached their loved ones, who had not yet been informed of what had happened. To avoid needlessly alarming family members, military policy was to search for a week before officially declaring men missing. In his last note to Ceci, Phil wrote of the moon over Hawaii and how it reminded him of the last time he saw her. "I'm waiting for the day when we can begin doing things together again as we used to do," he wrote. "I love you, I love you, I love you." On the weekend after the crash, the Zamperinis had a merry visit with Cuppernell's parents, who lived in Long Beach. Pete, now a Navy officer stationed in San Diego, wrote Louis about it, asking him to tell Cuppernell his parents were doing great. He tucked a photo of himself in the envelope. On the back, he wrote, "Don't let him clip your wings." As his brother's letter made its way toward Hawaii, Louis was on a raft far out in the Pacific. For the first time since he was a little boy, he prayed, speaking the words only in his mind. A week after Green Hornet vanished, the search was abandoned. Phil's crew was officially declared missing, and the process of informing family members began. On Oahu, an officer walked into the quarters that Louis, Phil, Mitchell, and Cuppernell had shared. He was there to catalog the men's belongings and send them home. Louis's room was mostly as it had been when he'd left that Thursday morning. A footlocker, a diary that ended with words about a rescue mission, a pin-up of actress Esther Williams on the wall. The note Louis had left on the locker was gone, as was the liquor. In Princeton, Indiana, on Friday, June 4, 1943, Kelsey Phillips, Phil's mother, received a telegram. "I regret to inform you that the Commanding General Pacific Area reports your son, First Lieutenant Russell A. Phillips, missing since May 27. If further details or other information of his status are received, you will be promptly notified." At Camp Pickett in Virginia, the same news reached Phil's father, who was serving as an Army chaplain. He took leave and rushed for home. The telegram reached the Zamperinis that same evening. Louis's mother, Louise, called Sylvia, who was living in a nearby suburb with her new husband. Sylvia became so hysterical that a neighbor ran to her, but Sylvia was crying too hard to speak. Sobbing, she got in her car and drove to Torrance. Pulling up at her parents' house, she put on a brave face. Her father was quiet. Her mother was consumed with anguish. Sylvia, who, like everyone else, assumed Louis had crashed in the ocean, told her mother not to worry. "With all those islands," Sylvia said, "he's teaching someone hula." Pete arrived. "If he has a toothbrush and a pocket knife, and he hits land," he said, "he'll make it." Louise found the snapshot taken the day Louis left, when he'd stood beside her on her front steps, his arm around her waist. On the back she wrote, "Louis reported missing, May 27th, 1943. Stanley Pillsbury and Clarence Douglas were in a hospital, trying to recover from the wounds incurred over Nauru. Douglas's shoulder was ravaged, and he seemed emotionally gutted. Pillsbury still couldn't walk. In his dreams, planes dove at him endlessly. Pillsbury was in his bed when Douglas came in. "The crew went down," he said. Pillsbury could barely speak. His first emotion was overwhelming guilt. "If I had only been there," he said later, "I could have saved it." On Oahu, Louis's friends hung a small flag in his memory. It would hang there as Louis, Phil, and Mac drifted west and the Allies carried the war across the Pacific and into the throat of Japan. In Torrance, Louise Zamperini's hands broke out in weeping sores, a consequence of her emotional trauma. Somewhere in those jagged first days, a fierce conviction came over her. Her son, she was absolutely certain, was alive. Chapter 14. Thirst. Phil felt as if he were on fire. The men's scalded skin cracked and their lips ballooned, bulging against their nostrils and chins. Their feet were cratered with quarter-sized salt sores. The water cans were empty. The rafts baked, emitting a bitter smell. The sharks circled. At last, on the third day without water, down came rain. The men spilled their bodies back, spread their arms, and opened their mouths as the water drummed over them. It was a sensory explosion. They had to find a way to save the water. The water tins, opened to the downpour, caught virtually nothing. Louis grabbed the air pump cases, tore the seams, spread the fabric into bowls, and let the rain pool, sucking it up and spitting it into the cans. Once the cans were full, he kept harvesting the rain, giving each man a drink every 30 seconds or so. For the moment, they had water, but they still had no food. They were ravenous. They stared into the ocean, crowded with fish, but they had no bait. They studied their shoes and wondered if they could eat the leather. They decided they couldn't. Days passed. They grew weaker. Louis resented Mac for eating the chocolate, and Mac seemed to know it. Louis sensed he was consumed by guilt. 9 or 10 days after the crash, Louis was lying back, wearing the air pump case as a hat, when he felt something alight on his head. It was an albatross. Slowly, slowly, Louis raised his hand, fingers open, then clamped down on the bird's legs. The bird pecked frantically, slashing Louis's knuckles. Louis grabbed its head and broke its neck. Louis used the pliers to tear the bird open. The men recoiled. The bird reeked. They tried to eat it, but gagged from the stench. Eventually they gave up. At least they finally had bait. Louis tied a small hook to a fishing line, baited it with albatross meat, and fed it into the water. A shark bit down on the hook and severed the line. Twice more, Louis tried, and twice more, sharks stole the hook. Finally, the sharks let a hook hang. Louis felt a tug and pulled up the line. On it hung a slender fish. It was their first food in well over a week. Between three men, a small fish didn't go far, but it gave them a push of energy. Louis had demonstrated that if they were persistent and resourceful, they could catch food, and he and Phil felt inspired. Mac remained unchanged. Phil reminded Louis that according to lore, killing an albatross was bad luck. After a plane crash, Louis replied, "What more bad luck could they have?" Several days passed. Louis caught nothing, and his hook supply dwindled. Periodically, rain replenished the water tins, but only part way. Phil began thinking about a magazine article he'd read, written by World War I ace pilot Eddie Rickenbacker. The previous fall, Rickenbacker's bomber had ditched in the Pacific. The raft-bound crew drifted for weeks, surviving on their two rafts' provisions, rainwater, fish, and bird meat. One man died, and the rest hallucinated, babbling at invisible people, arguing about their imaginary car. One man speaking to a specter that tried to lure him into the ocean. Finally, the rafts split up, and one reached an island. Natives radioed for help, and the other men were rescued. Rickenbacker wrote that he'd drifted for 21 days. He'd actually drifted for 24. And Phil, Louis, and Mac believed this was a record. In fact, the record for inflated raft survival appears to have been set in 1942, when three crash victims survived for 34 days. To Louis, the most important aspect of Rickenbacker's story was how quickly the survivors had gone insane. He remembered a college instructor telling him to think of the brain as a muscle, needing exercise to stay in shape. Louis was determined to keep himself and the others lucid. Soon after the crash, Louis began peppering Phil and Mac with questions on every conceivable subject. They shared their histories, from first memories onward. They reminisced about the best dates they'd ever had. Phil sang church hymns. Louis taught the other two the lyrics to White Christmas. They sang it Over the Ocean, a Christmas carol in June, heard only by circling sharks. Every conversation meandered back to food. Louis boasted about his mother's cooking, so Phil asked him how she made a meal. Louis began describing the preparation of a dish, and all three men found it satisfying. So Louis began a daily ritual, detailing breakfasts, lunches, and dinners. Devouring each imaginary meal, the men would describe every mouthful. They conjured up the scene so vividly that their stomachs were fooled, if only briefly. Once the food was eaten and the past exhausted, they moved to the future. Louis laid plans to open a restaurant. Phil spoke of seeing the Indy 500, maybe teaching school. And he talked about Ceci. In his mind, she never left him. For Louis and Phil, the conversations kept their minds sharp, pulled them out of their suffering, and set the future before them as something to live for. But Mac usually sat in silence. Though the others encouraged him, he couldn't see a future. The world was too far gone. The one thing they never discussed was the crash. Louis wanted to, but something about Phil stopped him. At times, Phil seemed lost in troubled thoughts, and Louis guessed he was reliving the crash, perhaps feeling responsible for his men's deaths. Louis wanted to reassure Phil he'd done nothing wrong, but feared raising the issue would be painful to him, so he said nothing. 2 weeks had passed. The rafts were decomposing, bleeding vivid yellow dye onto the men. They looked grotesque. Salt sores were marching up their legs and backs. Their flesh had evaporated. They were reaching a stage of their ordeal that, for other castaways, had been a gruesome turning point. In the history of seafaring, incidents of cannibalism among starving castaways weren't uncommon. But for all three Green Hornet survivors, the idea was unthinkable. Cannibalism wouldn't be considered, then or ever. The 2-week mark was a different turning point for Louis. He began praying aloud. He had no idea how to speak to God, so he recited snippets of prayers he'd seen in movies. Phil bowed his head as Louis spoke, offering Amen at the end. Mac only listened. The second albatross fluttered onto Louis's head around the 14th day. Again, Louis caught and killed it. When Louis opened it, they were relieved to find it didn't smell bad. They ate all of it. Because Mac was fading fastest, they gave him all the blood. Time spun out endlessly. Baiting his hooks with albatross meat and tiny fish from the bird's stomach, Louis caught a few fish, once parlaying a little one, thrown into the raft by a whitecap, into bait that yielded a bigger fish. Rains came intermittently, leaving the men sucking up every drop. Louis and Phil took turns leading prayers. Mac remained in his own world. Then the rains stopped and the water tins dried up. They reached day 21. They caught a fish and celebrated passing what they thought was Rickenbacker's mark. Louis was out of bait. Other than sharks, the only sea creatures that ventured within arm's reach were the small pilot fish that always swam alongside the sharks. But when Louis tried to grab them, they squirted away. With no more small hooks, Louis tried albatross bones, but the fish spat them out. He had an idea. He used fishing line to tie large hooks to his pinky, middle finger, and thumb, orienting them like claws. He held his hand over the water and waited. A shark, attended by a pilot fish, swam by. Once its head had passed, Louis sank his hand into the water. When the pilot fish moved under his hand, he snapped his fingers shut around it and yanked it from the water, jubilant. Sometime that week, a tern landed on the raft, and Phil clapped down on it. It was tiny and offered little meat, but not